The power you have as a manager depends a lot on how people perceive you. If you come across as earnest, sincere, knowledgeable, committed, and enthusiastic, you'll increase the chances that your ideas will be accepted by the receiver. What does the persuasion literature and research tell us about the presenter, the persuader? And what can we learn about the persuader's audience? What affects and controls persuasion? What adds to or inhibits the receiver's ability to participate in your presentation? Several key points are known about any persuader's audience. The first is that the people you're trying to communicate with don't have opinions as much as their opinions have them. We develop our opinions and values over long periods. Through a lifetime of conditioning, we come to believe certain things about politics, economics, roles of men and women. These opinions, once shaped, are very critical in determining our behavior. We might like to think of ourselves as being completely independent, having the freedom to choose to do whatever we want. While it's an overstatement to say that we're totally conditioned and have no freedom of choice whatsoever, we are largely the inheritors of life's experience. Our values and views of the world aren't likely to change greatly or easily once we reach adulthood. So when dealing with people, we have to keep in mind that they're not listening to us in a search for universal truth. Rather, they're listening to us based on values and opinions formed throughout their lives. We're not going to change people's opinions easily, so it's much more effective to go with the opinion flow which constitutes our listener's already present attitude. There's an interesting story about the Arizona Senator Carl Hayden, who served in the United States Senate until he was 89. On one occasion, he was approached by a youthful senator who wanted his vote on a particular issue. Senator Hayden indicated that he had already made up his mind. The young man pleaded, "Senator Hayden, won't you please listen to my speech on the Senate floor, because perhaps when you understand my logic and my reasoning, I'll convince you." And so he delivered a fabulous speech. It was filled with data, references, apt quotations, appropriate humor. The gallery was beside itself. The Senate members themselves stood as one at the conclusion of the young man's speech. He came off the Senate floor feeling the rush of success and said, "Senator Hayden, tell me, did my speech change your mind?" And Senator Hayden said, "Young man, I am impressed. Your speech did change my mind. I've heard lots of speeches that changed my mind, but I've never heard a speech that changed my vote." When we're trying to persuade people, we need to remember our goal is to change their votes, not their minds. That's a key distinction. It means that we don't care whether people see the world as we see it. As long as we can get their vote out of their own values, out of their own opinions and views, to support our particular plans and proposals. The second thing that we know about any audience is that individual opinions held within any group of managers are often group opinions. If you can identify any reference groups that a person associates with now or has associated with in the past, there's a pretty fair chance you can predict his values or his opinion on a particular issue. For example, if you're dealing with a white, male, Ivy Leaguer who's a member of the Methodist Church in an urban northeastern city, he's going to look at the world in a way that's quite different from a black female growing up in Mississippi. If you understand what reference points people have, you can often predict their behavior. Outside reference groups, churches, political parties, even the corporate norms or values within your own organization represent rewards, punishment, social acceptance, and status. And consequently, they are for certain things, and they are against other things. To some extent, of course, it depends on whether the person is a hardcore, central member of that reference group or whether they're just a fringe member. If they're a fringe member and only nominally involved, they'll be less inclined to follow group dictates. So ask yourself, as you look at the audience of 2 or 3, or 20 or 30, to what background, to what groups, do these people have some tie and connection? And what are the attitudes and positions of these various groups? If you can anticipate those positions, you'll be better equipped to work with their existing opinions. The third factor you need to consider when trying to persuade a person or a group is their personality. It's a fact that some people are easier to persuade than others. We know, for example, that generally speaking, and even with today's heightened sensitivity to this question, that women still tend to be more persuasible than men. There are a couple of ways to interpret this finding. One way to look at it is that women have been conditioned in the past to be passive. In pre-women's liberation thinking, they were conditioned to receive what male authority figures gave to them by way of instruction and direction. That interpretation would picture women as victims, and I think we need to be very careful how we handle that. On the other side of the fence, it may be that women are more open to persuasion simply because they're healthier human beings. There is a school of thought that says that because of differences between right brain and left brain dominance, which apparently may exist between men and women to some extent, women may be more inclined to go with a reasonable position. That is, their persuasibility may be normal, and the greater difficulty in persuading males may be an indication of their inability to understand the changing reality of situations. Take whichever interpretation you want, but look at your audiences and don't treat them as identical receivers of your message. Other personality traits that we know affect persuasion susceptibility is that those people who need to be loved, those that need to be accepted, and dependent kinds of people also want to feel that they're with you. So you present an idea, and because they don't want to risk putting you off, they'll nod their heads vigorously. Sometimes we'll see yes men behavior where the chief executive is waited upon to make a comment, and when he or she smiles, everybody smiles. Until that man or woman, that senior executive, takes an affirmative response, all the others wait. It reminds me of the executive who said to his subordinates, "I don't want you to be yes men. When I say no, you say no." And so, seekers of safety and security will be those who agree with you most quickly and whose agreement you may least need. Some of you may have had the frustrating experience of looking out over the audience and seeing all the heads bobbing up and down as they're trying to go with you and be nice people. And you see that there's only one head that isn't going up and down. Unfortunately, that head belongs to JB, the only decision maker in the room. To some extent, you don't need to worry about the opinions and attitudes of some of the members of the audience because they don't hold decision-making power. One other interesting finding is that sometimes the most decisive people are the easiest to persuade. On the one hand, we've portrayed those who are susceptible to persuasion as being rather soft in their personality structures, but it's also a fact that very decisive leaders and executives are often those who are easiest to persuade. That is, if your arguments are good, if they're sound, if there's logic and reasoning, they probably won't waffle. They'll make a decision, and you'll get a successful affirmative response. And so looking at that kind of an executive in the audience, it's always more comfortable than dealing with a wishy-washy executive who's known for taking too long in making up his mind. The fourth thing you have to remember when trying to persuade an audience is that the people you most often want in the audience are least likely to be there. Salespeople make their living on their ability to persuade. When they know the prime decision maker is going to be absent, they'll make a special presentation to that audience of one at another time. And the group presentation for other managers is primarily for sharing information. This raises the obvious question. Have you gone out of your way to make individual presentations? You can never count on the prime decision makers being present. The fifth characteristic we know about audiences, whether in group or one-on-one situations, is that when the audience participates, gets involved directly in the presentation of the idea, it helps to overcome resistance. I had a very interesting experience where a corporate board was about to hear a presentation from the marketing VP. Because this marketing executive was known for his excellent selling skills, the board agreed prior to the meeting that they were not going to buy anything that Ray presented to them that day. They said, "Look, let's all have an understanding. We're not going to vote on anything today." So when Ray walked into the room, they knew they could put Ray on hold no matter what he said. So what did Ray do? Well, he wasn't naive, and even though he didn't know anything about the agreement, he knew the way the group worked. So Ray came in and with great enthusiasm said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I've really got a problem. I know this is exactly the right marketing plan for us, but it seems to me that there are three budget situations we ought to consider. Budget situation number one is an ideal, expansionist, go-for-broke scenario. Situation number two is a worst-case scenario where we'd have to go just with nickels and dimes. And the third approach would be kind of a middle-of-the-road compromise. And he said, I just never had the ability to work with numbers quite the way I'd like, so I prepared three budget statements, and I need you to tell me which of these three budgets we should go with. So I'm going to break you into three groups and give each group one of the budgets to analyze. You see, what he did was to draw this whole group into the discussion of how much money they should spend. Whereas the initial position of the group had been, we're not going to approve anything. But Ray blew their resistance out of the water by getting his audience to participate in the matter at hand. The group went with the go-for-broke budget. A sixth point to remember is to try to get a public commitment from an audience or an individual receiver. Public commitments are harder to change later on than a private agreement. So what you need to do with an audience is to get them to go on record. Let's say you're in your boss's office and you get a decision. This is the way it's going to be, and then 2 days later you overhear that she's waffled on the agreement you thought you had. One way to avoid this would be, after getting the initial agreement, to come back to her office not more than 60 minutes later with a memo in her name that says, this is the way it's going to be. I'm establishing so-and-so in this particular area. Once that's been announced, it's going to be much harder for that executive to change her mind later. It helps solidify the commitment. Lastly, as we consider any audience, let's take a look at the time factor. One of the things we know is that no matter how inspired a person may be, no matter how much he believes in a particular position, in time that feeling can wear off. Sales meetings, for example, tend to be of this sort. You go to a meeting, some speaker comes in, gets everybody going rah, 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 and they're all cheering in the stands, then they walk out of the meeting. They drive through bad weather and crummy traffic to lunch where the waitress brings the wrong things and poof, the earlier excitement is gone. It's evaporated. On the other hand, the passage of time can have a positive impact on a listener, and this is called the sleeper effect. That means the chances of your audience's doing what you ask increase after the initial exposure. Think about it. Sometimes your first shot or presentation of the idea gets a cool reception. You walk out feeling like you haven't made any points, and yet your presentation was excellent. What's happened is that people have had some of their opinions challenged, or they were asked to look at the world in a different way, and the initial normal response to that is often cool. But in time you'll find there's often some change in your direction. To take into account both of these factors, you should give every group multiple exposures to your message. That's why advertising works. You hit them with a message, you hit them again, you hit them again, and pretty soon what you start seeing is a change in buyer behavior. No advertising campaign succeeds with single exposure. The second thing it suggests is not to be downhearted or discouraged when the receiver doesn't go for your concept immediately. It simply takes some time to get used to. Now that we've talked about the audience and receivers, let's turn our attention to the persuader. I'm talking about you and how you come across and what can be done to maximize your impact. The first thing I would ask is, are you a high credibility or a low credibility communicator in the eyes of your audience? By credibility, I mean the extent to which the audience believes your message and believes in you. There isn't any question here about your honesty. You may be honest and still not credible. They just don't believe in you. They don't know you yet. They don't know they can trust you. And consequently, particularly if you're the new kid on the block, you'll find that people very often tend to be suspicious. Are you a high or low credibility communicator in their eyes? Think about the last 10 proposal ideas that you presented to management. What percentage did you sell? If you say to me, Clay, I sold 7 or 8 of my last 10, then I would say to you that you are without doubt a high credibility communicator. Your batting average is so strong that management's going with you practically all the time. And of course, nobody bats 1,000. In a survey done annually by the Harris Opinion Poll, Americans were asked to name the most believable person they could think of. And for many years, the number one ranked position on that list belonged to Walter Cronkite. More people believed Walter Cronkite than any other public figure. Now, that isn't because he's necessarily a more honest person than the others. But there was something about Walter's demeanor, his competence, and always doing his homework. People would turn to Walter's channel, particularly if it was a big breaking story, a real trouble-in-the-world story, and say, "What's Uncle Walt saying about it?" High-credibility communicators, and you may be one, should probably ask for more opinion change than they've been asking for. You may have been making the mistake of selling too little to your receiving audiences. So start asking for considerably more than you've been asking for. The other suggestion for the high-credibility person is not to worry too much about giving both sides of an issue. Your receivers don't need that from you anymore. They believe you enough that they don't have to hear all sides of all stories. On the other hand, suppose one is a low-credibility person. Even though you're honest, your audience doesn't know that yet. This is sometimes true of the new person in the organization. When you look at this person's track record, you might find people are buying only 2 or 3 out of 10 proposals. The batting average is pretty low. If that's what you're experiencing right now, then ask for small changes. Don't ask for big changes because you won't get them. People don't trust you enough for that. So ask for some small thing. You're going to redesign the form. You're going to make a modest policy change. You want to run a little training program. Go in and ask for a series of small changes. When you've presented 6 or 7 of these smaller actions, then go in and ask for something that's a bit bigger. Develop trust over time. As people see that your small ideas turn out well, they'll start to feel comfortable and to relax with you. Then you'll be able to move on to more major projects. One other suggestion, if you're rated by your audience as having low credibility, is to always argue against your own best interests. You may know that going a particular way with a project idea is the only way it should be done, and yet it's required that you play devil's advocate. The person with low credibility must be very careful in listing both pros and cons and show both sides of the argument. What this communicates to your audience is, "Hey, the kid's not trying to pull the wool over our eyes. It looks like he's giving a well-balanced presentation here." Show them that you see not only the benefits, but the cost of what's going to be done. Any executive knows that any program, any decision, always costs them something, no matter what it gets them. So if you tell them, "Look, here's what it's going to cost you, but it's also going to get you these good things," there's a greater probability you'll persuade your listener. In terms of how you present yourself, the opening segments of your presentation are very important. The first 4 minutes of any personal relationship turn out to be absolutely critical. In that 4 minutes, you'll be judged on dress, speech, eye movement, and body language. There are studies that show that professional interviewers, those who should reserve judgment till the end of the interview, tend to make up their minds within the first 90 seconds of an interview. It's been found that salespeople often win or lose the sale in the first few minutes. Are such snap decisions valid? Usually not. But first impressions are crucial. Even as you flip around the TV dial to pick shows, you tend to spend less than 30 seconds deciding what program to watch. If a show doesn't grab you in the first instant, it's not going to get you at all. In the first period of a presentation, then, whether a one-on-one discussion or to a group, you need to work on building rapport and expressing some of the same views held by your audience. For example, if the issue of the day among your executives is budget cutting, and you're there with a proposal to spend $125,000, I suggest you start off by saying something like, "You know, the cost-cutting issue has got to be the number one problem we solve this year. There's no doubt in my mind that we've got to cut back and really hold the line. And while we're going to do that in my area of responsibility, I want to say I'm somewhat concerned because I sense that if we don't invest some money immediately, this current project that I'm proposing may wind up costing us more in the future." You must be seen by the audience as being on their side of the issue's fence. If you're not, they won't back you in the decision you're requesting. In the book of Corinthians, Paul writes, "To the Jews I became as a Jew, being myself a Pharisee." And when he was preaching to the Jews, he spoke out of the Mosaic law. To the Greeks, he said, "I became as a Greek." And he taught philosophy to them, as recorded in the book of Acts. To the barbarians, he wrote, "I became as a barbarian, in order that I might, by all means, save some." The concept is simply this. What kind of language do they speak? How do they think? Start with the audience where they are, wherever they are. You need to be seen as allied with them, and then take them from that starting point and go into whatever divergent or variant opinion you have. This reduces the initial barriers between you by showing them that you have some common views. You can also show common views by minimizing any differences in the way you dress or speak. Although we may be close physically, we may be very distant psychologically. So our goal, particularly in the early stages of a relationship or presentation, is to minimize psychological distance. If you look different from those around you, you're going to be seen as a foreigner. Some books suggest there is a certain executive uniform, and this executive dress is the basis for later success. It's true that some studies show if you wear dark colors, dark brown, gray, blue, black, that audiences will believe you're more sincere. They'll rate you as being a more sincere person than if you show up wearing Honolulu plaid. If the audience thinks you're more trustworthy when you look like a banker than when you look like a used car salesman, then dress that way. Sure, it's superficial, it's phony, it's cosmetic, and it can also backfire. Following the standard executive dress recipe, I remember showing up in West Virginia to do a management development program for a coal company. I was greeted that morning by my host, the coal company president, and I noticed right away that he didn't look like I did. There I stood in my little Brooks Brothers three-piece dark blue suit with a little pinstripe tie and wide starched collar with a collar bar. As he got out of his Lincoln Continental with the bulletproof glass, wearing a .38 on his hip, I noticed he was dressed in muddy boots, faded dungarees, and a plaid shirt with three buttons missing. He stared at me in amazement and said, "Where you going dressed like that, boy?" I said, "Well, Jimmy, we're going down to the little schoolhouse and have a session with the mine superintendents." And he said, "Son, you ain't going anywhere dressed like that. When you come to West Virginia, you got to learn to hunker down." And he took me down to the company store and got me a pair of boots, an old shirt, and jeans, used jeans. And I noticed as we moved into the meeting room that day that nobody turned around and looked at me like I was a stranger. I looked like one of them. I've learned as a communicator to try and vary my speech. I speak a little slower in some regions of the country and use some words differently. Why? Because I have no integrity and don't know who I am? No, because I'm trying to fit in and I don't want anything to interfere. I care about my audiences and I care enough about the message that I wouldn't want to stand in the way of either. If your boss wears a Brooks Brothers suit, you go out and buy one. On the other hand, as you look at your decision makers and the people you have to sell to, if they're wearing 1947 suits made in Manila, go out and custom order 12 of those babies and have one hanging in the closet first thing in the morning. There is, in the final analysis, only one rule for executive dress. Don't be variant or different. Save your originality for your ideas and thinking, because in your efforts to persuade, you better have more than just your suit going for you. One very troubling study showed that a communicator's ability to persuade was based primarily on how he presented his message. In a carefully controlled experiment, professional actors were hired and told to memorize a particular script for presentation. They then walked into a boardroom and presented the idea using identical visuals and words. The first actor in the experiment was kind of a Wally Cox, Mr. Peepers character. He looked like a mild-mannered nerd. In his squeaky voice, with uncertainty, he would come into the room and go through the pitch.
Well, as you can see, you have three alternatives in front of you. And the market is uncertain, but it would appear that this is the way we should go.
The board members, active decision makers, then made out their evaluation form. One of the questions was, would you support this proposal? A second actor, a Tom Selleck type, was then brought in with exactly the same visuals, using exactly the same message and logic, only this time he took a very assertive stance and said, well, as you can see, we have three alternatives in front of us. The market is uncertain, but it would appear that this is the way we should go. And then the group rated that presenter. You're probably way ahead of me at this point. You've guessed that the one who took the assertive stance was the one who sold it to the board members. So there are some key points to keep in mind. One is, there are a lot of good ideas in your organization that will fail today. They'll go down in flames, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with the ideas, absolutely nothing wrong with the concepts, absolutely nothing wrong with the data on which they're based. But because the presenter couldn't put it across, an otherwise excellent idea often goes down to failure. When people make presentations to you, listen, if you can, to more than the personality. Go beyond their style and listen to their content. Judge by content and worth rather than the externals of appearance. The other obvious conclusion is this: all things being equal, you must play the man, in Shakespeare's words. You must sound good. You must project. Even when you're in positions where you lack confidence, even when you have some stage fright and some jitters, say it with gusto. Say it with certainty. Say it as though you really believe in it. I assume you do, or you wouldn't be recommending it. Be authoritative. Have a command language and a command presence. People trust that. They go with it. It counts that you have firm control in this situation. And when you present, use as much in the way of media multipliers as you can. Use media techniques to increase a sense of drama and to multiply your message. That means visuals, chart pads, handouts, anything that requires your audience to get involved. Tell a story rather than just reeling off numbers. Vary the pitch. Let television be your guide. We're dealing with a sophisticated, media-bombarded generation. We're dealing with people who've had years of multiple images flashing at them rapidly. A lot of color, a lot of movement, and a lot of action occurring. It's hard, if not impossible, to duplicate that in a day-to-day business environment. Yet to the extent that you can get some additional technique into your presentation, so much the better. You may want to join the local chapter of Toastmasters International. There you'll be given speaking opportunities, both for carefully scripted presentations as well as for extemporaneous remarks. Presentation is the kind of skill that simply requires practice, practice, practice. You might volunteer to teach Sunday school class or class at synagogue. If you're active in politics, see if you can be a speechwriter. Put yourself in situations where you're forced to write and speak. We know, too, that it's generally better to try to persuade someone in person where you can communicate with force. We can see the facial reactions. We can get the questions. It becomes a dialogue, and it's always easier. The reality, however, is that many of the projects and problems that we're working with are so complex and so detailed that they have to be put in writing. And so how we express ourselves in writing also becomes very crucial to selling an idea. Thoreau's famous quotation from his book Walden about the secret of life was the two-word sentence, simplify, simplify. Certainly that has to be the rule in writing. Entirely too many mistakes are made in written communication, not because the person was a poor communicator, but because he was an over-communicator. So simplify the concepts, simplify the language, and simplify the expression of your request. Can you say it in fewer words? Can you use simpler language? If you use single-syllable words, they'll probably understand you. If you use two-syllable words, some of them will start to misunderstand you. If you use three-syllable words, a whole bunch of people are going to tune out. If you use four-syllable words, there's no way in the world they're going to be with you. One study examined pieces of prose and poetry committed to memory by millions of people. Is there something in the language itself that would tell us what makes it powerful? Something that's been memorized by a lot of people suggests communication that is right on target. The kinds of things that people memorize are the Lord's Prayer, the 23rd Psalm, and the preamble to the Constitution. Those selections are typically short messages. There are seldom any words over two syllables, so follow their lead and keep your message short and use small words to describe big concepts. As you put things in writing, try to fit the new proposal into the existing framework of the organization. Previously, I've indicated that bosses like to buy evolutionary, not revolutionary, change. In like fashion, all others who are going to be involved in understanding and interpreting the data need to go from a bridge of what is known and commonly understood into the new area, which is always suspect because it's unknown. So build that bridge to transition by showing people how it fits with what's going on now. Remember, too, the directive that Churchill gave to his generals during World War II. In the midst of Dunkirk, when the British Army faced the possibility of annihilation, he was besieged with huge reports from field commanders telling him of the problem. Decisions had to be made very rapidly, and there was no way that Churchill could wade through all the reports. He issued an order to all commanders to supply him with a one-page summary of each of their reports. He found it worked so well that he continued to maintain that system of written communications throughout the war. If you have recommendations, they should go up front on page one. Anything else should go into data appendices. If you're a high-credibility communicator, nobody's ever going to look at that stuff anyway. Another suggestion is to offer alternatives and identify the gain and loss ratio expected with each. Often when you write things down, you won't be present to defend your ideas when they're read later. Therefore, anticipate the objections and have answers available to the reader. And finally, in written communications, lay out the steps to implementation. A lot of people fail in written proposals to show step by step how to go from idea or concept to the point of actual use. This is known as completed staff work. As a staff person or persuader, our job is to spell out what has to be done. All executives should have to say is, "Yes, I support this." If you have to come back later, you run a chance that the whole thing is going to get derailed. So when people buy your plan, see if you can get them to buy it as a complete package. Benjamin Franklin was probably the most successful persuader among our founding fathers. Franklin was responsible for two primary decisions which assured the young nation's success. During that hot summer in Philadelphia, when Congress was discussing the Declaration of Independence, there was no unanimity, no sense of national unity. It was not uncommon for delegates from one colony or another to walk out of the proceedings, vowing never to return. Usually they were followed by a tap, tap, tapping of an old man's cane. Franklin, the kindly grandfather figure that everyone respected, would follow after them. He'd support them, reinforce them, tell them how much they were needed. He'd point out how accurate they were in seeing that which others did not understand. Whether it was Northerners, Southerners, plantation owners or shipbuilders, he walked on both sides of the street and said to each whatever was necessary to keep the group working together. A second major focus of his persuasion came in France during the war years. Some people believe that George Washington won the Revolutionary War because he suffered through Valley Forge. 3,000 of the 11,000 soldiers who entered Valley Forge froze to death that winter. You really don't win many wars by freezing to death. It's a mark of suffering and of character, but it's not a sign of victory. When Cornwallis surrendered the following spring, it wasn't because he was overpowered by Washington's ragtag army. It was because he couldn't get resupplied by sea. He couldn't get food, ammunition, or fresh troops. That's because the British Navy couldn't get through the French blockade. The French Navy was preventing the English from landing on the orders of the King of France. The French King issued the orders because the French Queen had told him to, and the French Queen had told him to because she and the ladies of her court, who were influential, all like Dr. Franklin. He had been wining and dining them, even though some members of Congress were very critical of his expense accounts. Even so, Franklin succeeded in gaining, at a very crucial time, a military ally who had the sea power to give our land forces the chance to be victorious. What did Franklin say about persuasion? The way to convince another is to state your case moderately and accurately. Then scratch your head or shake it a little and say, that's the way it seems to you, but then of course you may be mistaken about it. This causes your listener to receive what you have to say, and like as not turn about and try and convince you of it, since you're in doubt. But if you go at him in a tone of positiveness and arrogance, you only make an opponent of him. Franklin understood very well the concepts of executive behavior and thinking. By effectively carrying out the rules and responsibilities of top management, by thinking strategically in order to create the future, by using power to make things happen, and by building support for your ideas, you can build a great future for yourself, your organization, and your country. Do that, my friend, and you will be an uncommon leader.